Good evening.
Yes, a huge adjustment. Oh my God.
Justice Iacobucci, distinguished guests, and panel members. I welcome you, and I welcome all of our articling students tonight who have taken the leap into the public sector, an area of law in which I hope you will bring justice to the service of the public. I actually thought that tonight was going to be the new calls reception. That's going to be on November the 1st, and I was ready to congratulate you all on your call to the bar. Now, just have to remind you that it is an offense to practice law without a license. It's not an offense to grant a license to practice law, although it won't mean very much if you get it from here. And if I do that by mistake, my next meeting with the treasurer of the Law Society is going to be a little bit less cordial than I'm used to. The plus side of that mistake would have been that they could have saved the cost of renting out Roy Thompson Hall for the day, and we can send the bar bill to the Law Society. The false confusion here, if you're into interior design, the faux confusion, recognizes that the Law Society is the regulator. It's the body that protects the public from you. The Bar Association advances your interests in the public sphere and against undue control from the Law Society. Sorry about that, Janet.
I hope I can reply.
That undue will never happen, of course. We are the promoters. We are here for you.
Bonsoir, je m'appelle Yakazaki. Je suis le président de l'ABO. Je vous accueille avec bras ouverts au sein de notre association. Je voudrais d'abord reconnaître le rôle intégral des avocats dans le secteur public, dans la protection et dans la promotion des valeurs démocratiques dans les relations entre l'État et les citoyens. À l'ABO, nous sommes fiers que tous les avocats qui sont membres de notre association contribuent aux délibérations importantes en ce qui concerne le réforme des droits, les besoins des avocats et l'avenir de notre profession.
I'm not going to sell you on the services of the OBA. I'm not going to sell you on the advocacy on behalf of lawyers, both in private practice and in public service. And I'm not going to ask you to think about the networking opportunities that lie ahead, collegial ties that will last a lifetime. And I'm not going to talk about the work we do to advocate for judges and members of other tribunals, for we speak whereas they cannot. I am only here to welcome you. But this welcome is one with a few strings attached. As articling students tonight, I'm calling upon you to help me fulfill a promise to the Ontario Bar Association. I'm asking you not only to join the OBA, and if you're already a member, to continue, but also to take an active part. We will find a place for you to do something here. We will also find a mentor for you here. And as time goes by, we will find a mentee when you become a mentor. The OBA is the only place in Ontario where you, as a public service lawyer, can become a leader within the entire legal profession, both public and private.
Alors, vous avez trouvé le sentier ici vers l'excellence. Vous ne regrettez jamais votre décision de devenir un avocat. Vous ne regrettez jamais votre décision de devenir un membre de l'ABO. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. And I'd like to call upon Julie Jay to commence the program.
Merci, Lee. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the annual Articling Student Reception, which is hosted by the Public Sector Lawyers Section of the Ontario Bar Association in conjunction with our sister sections. My name is Julie Jay, and I'm the chair of the Public Sector Lawyers Section. As you might guess from our name, our section focuses on the practice of law in the public sector and brings together an incredibly diverse group of practitioners who are united by their desire to do work which serves the public good. This can take many forms, and our membership reflects the wide variety of career paths available in the public sector, from working directly for a municipal, provincial, or federal government, to careers with a university, hospital, tribunal, public accountability body, agency, or regulator, or perhaps even in the private sector working for a public sector body. If you've not already done so before this, before we gathered in this room, I hope that you'll take a minute after the formal proceedings end to speak to one of the members of the public sector section executive who are here this evening. We're identified by the plastic casing around our name tags, which gives us special super mingler status. So if there's anyone you'd like to speak to, now is a very good opportunity to do so. And I hope that you'll consider joining the Ontario Bar Association and the Public Sector Lawyers Section. And your articling year is the ideal time to get involved and to reap the benefits of belonging to a professional association. We have a great panel this evening, and I'd like to thank all of our speakers. And each of our four speakers demonstrate different ways in which lawyers can contribute to the public interest. So I hope you enjoy the panel. And I'd now like to pass the mic over to our two co-chairs, Valerie Jepson, who is counsel with the Office of the Integrity Commissioner, and Monica Rahman, counsel with the extradition team of the Department of Justice.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Monica Rahman, and I'm joined here today with my colleague Valerie Jepson. So we're the program chairs for this reception, and I'm not going to take very much time, but I did want to say that we're very happy to welcome you to this year's welcome reception and to the OBA and the profession at large. This may be one of the first larger gatherings that you've been to, and so we hope you enjoy yourself and learn something from our great panelists.
So, as you all know, we're tremendously fortunate to have with us four very distinguished members of the legal profession who bring with them extensive knowledge from their diverse backgrounds working in both public and private sector law.
So we'll start off briefly just by giving you an introduction to the four speakers. The first speaker on my left is the Honorable Frank Iacobucci. Mr. Iacobucci has had a varied career in private practice, academia, government, and the judiciary. He started his career practicing in corporate and securities law at a New York law firm and also held a variety of positions at the University of Toronto, including being the Dean of the Faculty of Law as well as the Vice President and Provost at the University. In 1985, Mr. Iacobucci was appointed Deputy Minister of Justice and Deputy Attorney General for Canada. A few years later, he was appointed Chief Justice of the Federal Court of Canada, and in 1991, as we all know, he was appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. Since retiring from the Supreme Court in 2004, Mr. Iacobucci has joined Tories LLP, but is also active in many initiatives and organizations, including as the chairman of the Higher Education Quality Council of Ontario, federal representative in the settlement of the Indian Residential Schools Legacy, and commissioner of a high-profile public inquiry, to name just a few. Next, we have Janet Miner, who's general counsel in the constitutional law branch of Ontario's Ministry of the Attorney General. After 2 years of general litigation at the firm of Manning Bruce, Janet joined MAG in 1977 and has worked in public law since that time. She has appeared before all levels of court and has argued many significant cases on behalf of the Ontario government. And Janet is also an elected bencher of the Law Society of Upper Canada, was the past director of the Advocate Society, and continues to be active in a number of professional organizations, including as a board member of the Ontario Lawyers Assistance Program and the Ontario Justice Education Network. This past year, she was just awarded the Tom Marshall Award of Excellence in Public Sector Law for her outstanding achievements in promoting the public interest through her work.
Sitting next to Janet is Carla Lyon. Carla is the Regional Director General and is responsible for the overall management of the Department of Justice operations in the Ontario region. She's practiced with the Department of Justice since being called to the bar in 1982. She started her practice in the area of commercial and real property transactions and later became the director of Aboriginal and business law sections. In 2008, she was appointed Regional Director General of the Ontario Regional Office. Carla's career includes national advisory work for Transport Canada on the administration of the national airport system, ground leases, and work on notable files such as the Terminal 3 development project. And sitting next to Carla is Freya Christensen. Freya practices with the firm Cavaluzzo, Hayes, Shulton, McIntyre, and Cornish. She was called to the bar in 1989 after clerking with the Supreme Court of Canada for Mr. Justice McIntyre. And she was a partner at a national law firm for many years before she joined Cavaluzzo, Hayes. Freya practices in administrative law, pension and benefits, and civil litigation. She's a teacher at the U of T Law School in administrative law. I know Freya because she provides me with advice at my office, the Office of the Integrity Commissioner. She provides advice to many public sector clients like mine. She provides advice in statutory interpretation, investigations, development of rules, policies, and procedures. Notably, Freya was the lead counsel on the Military Police Complaints Commission in the Afghanistan Public Interest Hearing. She was a lead counsel in the Arar Public Inquiry Policy Review, and she was counsel for the Walkerton Inquiry. Freya also has had involvement in the OBA, and so we're very happy that Freya is here and that all of our panelists are here. I'm going to turn it back over to Monica to moderate the panel.
So as is evident, the format we've chosen for tonight's discussion is a panel, which will start and end with a general question for the whole panel, but in the middle we'll have individual questions for each of the speakers to draw on their particular backgrounds and give you the full benefit of their experience. So just before I start, I just wanted to let you know that you are able to take the microphones off the stands if that's what you're comfortable with, or turn them towards you, and I'll leave the option to you. So the first question I have is one for the whole panel, and that is whether it was a conscious decision you made to practice in the public sector, and if you could perhaps tell us some of the key experiences or reasons that led you to gravitate towards public sector law. Maybe we can start with Mr. Iacobucci.
Well, can you mind if I sit down?
You can stay.
Yeah, it's okay. Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be here for a lot of reasons, but I have a feeling that my major reason for being here is that you wanted to boost the average age of the panelists considerably, and so you invited me. But even if that's the reason, I'm very happy to be here. When I thought of participating, you obviously you think back, and I don't want to make this a Monty Python sketch about my life and so on. But there have been so many wonderful things that have changed over the last 50 years, because it's basically 50 years that I've been involved in the law, and I've seen just many, many changes for the better. And when I look around the room and see the faces and the backgrounds that are reflected in those faces, that makes me feel really good about the changes that have taken place in our profession. And I don't want to get into all that, but that's not what you're here for. But I can only say to you that there have been profound changes, and there still are ongoing changes that you all can play a major role in to make sure that the profession is accessible to those that want to be lawyers, that those that come from backgrounds that are not traditional. And so I would want to emphasize that. Now, let's go to the question. I really didn't plan my career, or if one ever plans a career, to get directly involved with the public service. I started off as a lawyer in New York Why? Because my wife was also a lawyer, and we wanted to get a job, and we wanted to get married too, and hopefully live in the same city. And it was easier for us to get a job in New York than it was for her to get one, for me to get one in New York, than it was for her in Ontario. This is going back some years. And so we went to New York and city, and we were in one of these big, she was in a different firm from me, but I was, so I never, I was really looking at survival. And I want to make it known that I struck out on so many offers that I thought I would get a lot of offers, but I didn't get very many offers because I was an unknown quantity and so on. But in any event, we stayed for 3 years, and then I went into a public service job at the University of Toronto. And I wasn't planning to go, but I was so grateful for the opportunity to go to the Department of Justice in 1985, as was mentioned. And I have to say that I think the university was good preparation for the Department of Justice. The University of Toronto had a huge, huge employment force. It was one of its presidents used to say we should have a banner that welcomed people to the University of Toronto. Welcome to the University of Toronto. Process is our most important product. And when I joined the public service, I thought, well, maybe their banner would be bigger than the banner at the University of Toronto. But it was good preparation for me. So I was just fortunate to be asked to go to the public service. I have to say I would have had a tremendous gap in my work experience if I had not gone to the Department of Justice. I used to say to my colleagues in the Justice Department, and I think, Freya, we may have overlapped. If you started in 82, I don't know how long you were there. Carla, you were there. How long was I there when I was? Were you there?
Yes.
Did we?
Okay.
Well, that's another one of my mistakes, I guess. But in any event, I certainly had a lot of contact with others in the office who would come to Ottawa for different things. But the point is, I could say, and I would say to all of you in the public service, you have the best client any lawyer can have, the people. I profoundly believe that. It's not a catchy phrase. It's something that is very, very special. I'm not saying there are other clients that are, you've got duties, but there's just not something very special about it. So I didn't plan. I lucked out. But I have said since that experience, any time I get asked for career advice, I'd say please include public service in your plans. I mean, I don't mean to say that everyone's cup of tea, but I do think having that experience in your journey through life, both personally and professionally, I can't recommend it highly enough. Lots of reasons for that, but I've talked enough, and I'll let other people speak.
Thank you. Thanks, Frank. Can you hear? Okay. Well, much like Frank, I had no plans whatsoever to join the public sector. When I was in law school, I wanted to be a litigator. I was interested in all sorts of areas of law, and my main goal was to find an articling job and then hopefully another job where I could litigate, and I did. And as it happened, the firm that I worked at had a mixed general practice, including family law,
And in law school, I was very interested in family law because that was the burgeoning era of women's rights. I discovered that the actual practice of it was somewhat different than the academic study of it, and I also discovered that I was totally unsuited for that. At the same time, I also discovered that I wasn't terribly interested in motor vehicle litigation, and there was a lot more of that at the time because that was before No Fault. So I was, and I also felt that I wasn't getting enough on my feet experience. Now, this was completely bogus now that I realized that I was probably getting more than a lot of people, but I was ambitious and keen, and so I thought I wasn't. So I thought, I think this is not the firm for me. They were all very nice people, but it was really a subject area issue. And I was casting about for a different litigation job. And I was applying at all sorts of different private firms, and it happened that my colleague Lorraine Weinrib, who's now at U of T,
whose daughter is here.
Yes, who's our articling student this year, was working at the Ministry of the Attorney General, and it just, again, coincidentally, there was a case that came up, and the director and she were on it, and a senior person from the firm and I were also on it. We were kind of on the same side. Anyway, there was a job opening, and I applied for it, and I got it. But it was no great decision to leave the private sector for the public. In fact, when you think of it, it's kind of the wrong reasons. Oh, they don't do family. Oh, they don't do motor vehicle, and I'll get a lot of on-my-feet experience. And I was also faced with, there was a lot of prejudice against government lawyers at the time, and I'm not sure there's still not some around, but there was a lot then. And people were saying to me, oh, Janet, you don't want to go there. I mean, there aren't very good lawyers. I mean, if you were a good lawyer, you'd want to work in the private sector, blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, I got there, and I thought, well, I can stay a couple of years. I'll get good on-my-feet experience. It'll be another base to, you know, make another move or whatever. And then I got extremely interested in what we now call public law, but admin law, which I have to say, I confess now, Frank was a professor when I was at U of T. I think I didn't understand admin law when I was at U of T.
But
I know you didn't, but I'm still embarrassed. But in fact, the practice of it, it turned out that I was fascinated by it. And again, it was a wonderful time to be both learning and practicing admin law, because this is 1977. This is the age the Judicial Review Procedure Act had just come in, the Statutory Powers and Procedure Act had just come in. This is the era of Nicholson. I can still remember Nicholson coming out. I mean, and you can imagine now it's just taken for granted, but it was a real, it just had shockwaves through people who practiced. So it was a very exciting time, and I got very interested in the law intellectually. I found out there were excellent lawyers there from whom I learned a very great deal, and I'm still learning a very great deal. And I got really kind of hooked. And that's when I made my decision. So it was not when I moved. It was after I was there. And then that office, it was called Crown Office Civil, also did work for the Human Rights Commission. That was kind of hived off as wanting to separate it more later on. But at that point, we still did that. The constitutional people did pretty well division of powers, which, again, I'm embarrassed to say I thought was boring. But when the charter came along, constitutional litigation changed quite a lot. I was very interested in that. They needed somebody who had my kind of litigation experience. And again, through almost sort of serendipity, I think, I was asked would I, you know, take on some charter cases. And so my first big case there was McKinney, if you can even remember that. And that was really exciting. I loved it. And then the person in charge of all of that said, if you're really going to do constitutional, you better move over. And then I discovered that I really enjoyed federalism issues too. So the whole thing was kind of a learning experience for me, and I have to say that the practice of public law involves a huge amount of variety. People say, oh, you're in constitutional, that's so narrow. That's not narrow at all. We deal with every subject area in government, from education to health to transportation to environment. There's huge intellectual variety there. There's lots of intellectual challenge in constitutional litigation or any other kind of public law issues, and an opportunity to serve the public. So I think it's a wonderful place to be.
So we had two people who seem to accidentally have fallen into a career of public sector law. Carla?
Well, actually, you've got a third, okay? I think everything that has happened in my career has been by accident. I'm going to move this over just a little bit more. I've been in the federal government for a long, long time, and Monica, I want to thank you for not having included in the information in my bio just how long I have worked for the federal government. I don't think you needed to worry about raising the mean thing. Anyway, in the last year of my undergrad, it dawned on me that I didn't have the money to do what I wanted to do next, which was to go to law school, and that what I really needed was a job. And by accident, in the common room one morning, I'm reading the newspaper, and there's an ad by the Public Service Commission of Canada urging students to join the public service and to write the exams. And they were being, this was a Wednesday, they were being held on the Friday, okay? So I thought, okay, they're promising me a challenging career, the opportunity to travel, and they're going to give me French language training to boot. What have I got to lose except 3 hours writing these exams? So I went and I wrote the exams. I passed. Went through a number of interviews, got a job offer, and at the end of university, I was off to Ottawa. And I told myself, okay, you'll stay for a year, you'll save your money, and you'll head off for law school. Well, the ad didn't lie. I got a very challenging job. I traveled from one end of Canada to the other. They sent me to Quebec City to study French, and I loved it. However, as everything goes in my life, things changed. My boss retired, and within the 15 minutes during which I met my new boss, I knew that this wasn't going to work. I couldn't work for this guy. That was a Thursday, okay? The last LSAT for admission to law school the following September was on Saturday morning. So I thought, what have I got to lose? I'll just go write the exam, right? Okay, so I went and I wrote the exam, and I passed, and I got accepted into Osgoode, and managed to negotiate a leave of absence from the federal government. Fortunately, I knew a couple of people a bit higher than this new guy I was working for. So I got a leave of absence to go to law school for 3 years to article and do my bar admission course. Well, strangely enough, my story's a bit like yours. I thought I wanted to practice family law. So I got an articling job at a very small firm here in Toronto that specialized in family law. And I discovered within the first 2 months that I didn't like this one bit. It didn't resemble anything I'd done in law school. So I knew right then this was not going to be my career choice. However, sort of as an incidental to the family law practice, this firm did some real estate work, selling the houses when people divorced, and some general litigation work, small claims court work when both of them claimed the mantle clock, that kind of thing. All right, well, I found out that I really liked that. I really liked real estate. And the two partners in the firm were very happy to let their articling student go off and do the real estate work and go off and do the general litigation in small claims court. So that's what I did. End of articles. They said they wanted me to come back. Tried not to say no too forcefully. Went off to bar admission course, which was 6 months in those days. And towards the end of that, it sort of dawned on me that I probably did need a job. Okay? And I had never really intended to go back to the federal government. But a colleague of mine, former colleague, said, well, why don't you just try applying to the Department of Justice? You might like it. Well, in those days, there was no Google. You couldn't Google and find out what the Department of Justice did. I had no idea what they did, quite frankly. But I sent in my resume, and I got called to come in for an interview. I was really impressed with the two lawyers who interviewed me. I told them quite quickly that the two main areas of law that the Department of Justice did, criminal and tax, I had absolutely no interest in whatsoever. Told them that I liked really commercial work and some civil litigation and some real estate. And one of them said, well, it just so happens we need somebody to do real property law, commercial work, and bankruptcy. Would you be interested? Okay, and this is where I said it's by accident. I mean, it's exactly what I wanted to do, so I said yes on the spot. And I've wound up at the Department of Justice, and I have had the most fantastic career, without a doubt. I did a little bit of litigation at the start, and then I got involved in doing some advisory-type work for Transport Canada, And somebody asked me when I was a five-year call if I wanted to get involved with the negotiations for the Terminal 3 construction project, which was probably the biggest deal on Bay Street in 1987. And I said yes, and I've never looked back. It's just been a wonderful career, and I commend it. And I think the best thing about it is that I have this sense that I really am serving Canadians, and that's very important to me.
This is very inspirational. Make it four for four. Because, and that's an interesting lesson, that people that have risen to the top and obviously still love what they do after many, many years, are passionate about what they do. We've all fallen into it and have pursued our passions or have found passion through whatever it is we have encountered. I am a private sector lawyer. I'm not a full-time public servant, but I've spent a significant amount of my career, and now pretty well all of my career, advising public bodies or working for commissions of inquiry. I went to the University of Victoria Law School, where I did something called the public law term, because the reason I went to law school is I think I was interested in how the state regulates the conduct of individuals and groups and how the collective will of Parliament is expressed through law and what the limits of that should be, all very airy-fairy stuff. And I went to clerk after that at Supreme Court of Canada with an incredible man, Justice McIntyre, who is now deceased. But he was of an age that his concept of a lawyer was, and what he did in practice, one day you draft a will, and the next day you defend a capital murder case. And he believed that our job as lawyers is to serve the people of the community by using our skills in whatever way. And he has been a tremendous inspiration to me, because I think, how best can I use my skills in our community? I didn't, because I went to UVic, it was a far less sophisticated time. They didn't have all these placement services that you guys have and try to match you up. Sort of people called around the court, firms come up, you know, would you like to come here? Dennis O'Connor, who's now Associate Chief Justice of Ontario, asked if I wanted a job, and I said, that sounds great. I didn't know anything about Borden and Elliott, now BLG. And I spent 20 years there. And with Dennis, I did a tremendous amount of public interest and public law work. And I find it a little bit sad because Bay Street is changing. When I grew up in the law, all of the big downtown firms did believe in supporting the work of the public sector. So whether it was, you know, working on a variety of JRs or offering their students, you know, on secondments or encouraging people to work for agencies, boards, and tribunals. As the price point has changed on Bay Street, it's become increasingly difficult, and you see far fewer downtown lawyers engaging or assisting, you know, mainline agencies, boards, commissions, and governments. And I think that's sad because I always found it to be a tremendous inspiration as a private lawyer to be able to work in the public interest. But I think sometimes if you start your career on the private side, I often thought about coming into government full-time, but I've had too much fun. It's never been the right time to leave. I know. It's never been the right time to leave what I'm doing. But I think the one lesson from our collective introduction is that none of us planned it, and we've had a lot of fun along the way. And have enjoyed every minute of it. And whatever it is you're doing, that's what you have to think about. Is this what I could stand to do for the next 30 or 40 years? Am I loving it so I don't even notice? For me, 21 years have gone by. I'm in the latter category. So I hope you find your way in whatever path you pursue.
Well, with that, maybe I'll delve into some of your career choices a little bit deeper, or rather the lessons you've learned or wisdom you can pass on from your own career experience. Mr. Iacobucci, in your capacity as the Chief Justice of the Federal Court of Canada and also as a Justice of the Supreme Court, you've heard submissions from lawyers from all kinds of backgrounds. And so I would like to ask, what were the strengths that you appreciated most from public sector lawyers that appeared before you? And maybe you could give us a little bit about your view on the special duties and responsibilities of lawyers that represent the Crown.
Well, yeah, I'd be pleased to make some comments on those matters. The first thing I'll say is to get back to something that Janet mentioned, and that is this issue about, you know, the quality of lawyers in the public service versus the private sector. And from my time in the Federal Justice Department, and I had opportunities to observe colleagues from provincial justice departments, so I would include them in what I'm about to say. Some of the best lawyers I've ever met in my life have come from the public sector. There's just absolutely no doubt of that. I can name lawyers on the solicitor side, and I can name lawyers on the litigation side and on the policy side when I make that statement. They were outstanding. There's a lot that choose this. All of us went into this public sector accidentally, but a lot choose to go, and those that chose, I saw excellence that was unsurpassed in on Wall Street or on Bay Street, where I am now. I don't mean to say they're not good lawyers in those firms, and of course not. They are good lawyers, but to say that this public service takes second place, I just can't abide that. I just don't. And you know, I think that's waned a bit, but maybe I'm wrong. I think Janet's right that there's still some remnants of that kind of silly thinking. But in terms of lawyers that I saw as a judge, I also want to say this. There is no monopoly of any place on quality of advocates in the court systems of our country. It's just not. There's excellence in the civil side of Quebec. There's excellence in common law provinces. It's not just big city folk. You know, we don't have an elite the way the American Supreme Court bar has an elite. We have some that go up more often than others, and a lot of them are people that are here or their colleagues from the public service. And it's not just the male bastion. Women litigators stand out in my mind. And so that was the most wonderful thing about having that opportunity to see, particularly at the Supreme Court, that breadth of excellence that was not centralized or focused in gender or in region or in private sector versus public sector. And some of the best criminal lawyers are the prosecutor types from the governments of our country. That should be more widely, if you like, known. I say it every time I can get the chance to do so. I think what you appreciate in any lawyer in as a judge is excellence in advocacy. And, you know, that's a subject on which so much has been written by so many times, but probably so little results. I don't want to go on to that. But you know, good advocacy is what you want, no matter where it's from, in what context and so on. And that, you know, means really knowing the case really well, preparing well more than, you know, the hearing in a courtroom is like the iceberg, right? It's just the tip. And all of that preparation time is ahead of time is way more than that little 1 hour, 2 hour, or 3 hour, or maybe even a 2 day hearing that you get. And that goes the same for the judiciary, because their preparation has to be really top class, because the lawyers will not appreciate it if it isn't. So it's good advocacy. That's very, very important. The thing that I think is different about the public sector litigators is this. No one litigates more than the governments. That stands to reason. Particularly in our society, where government is, as Jeff Simpson said years ago, I thought quite nicely. Government in our system, unlike the Americans, is a friend, not a foe. We wouldn't have this country without strong government and a presence in our society that represents the values of Canadian people, namely a welfare state, a involvement by government in so many things. And that means you're going to get into conflicts, and that means you're going to go to the courts because you can't settle them all. And that brings me to the point that I believe that when government lawyers come into court, it shouldn't be just a transactional emphasis on the outcome in a particular case, because it's a relationship that government lawyers have with boards and tribunals and institutions. And so those lawyers are not just representing themselves in their own career sense, they're also representing their particular, whether it's the Attorney General or whatever branch of government they may be speaking on behalf of or arguing on behalf of. And so you don't look into this kind of victory at any cost if it's just merely a transaction. You're going to be back there many times, and I think that's important to keep in mind in terms of your approach to oral and written argument. And I also think there's another dimension, is that you are representing the peers of your colleagues. And if you're going to be not conscious of that, you're doing your peers a disfavor, because it just takes one example of bad manners or inappropriate, if you like, behavior to taint others. That doesn't seem to get as emphasized as much, I don't think. It's not as central. I'm not saying anybody from a big firm doesn't have sensitivities about his colleagues or the reputation of the firm and so on and so forth. But it's really important, I think, for the government public sector lawyers to keep that in mind. And it's an example of the end is, to get the result for you. Client, whether it's the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's Department, or another Department of Government, the means you employ to achieve that result are every bit as important. And as I said, I look back on 18 years of judging, and as an alumnus of a public service lawyer role, I was quite proud of the quality of representation that lawyers, and I'm not just talking about the federal department, I'm talking about lawyers from across the country, from the public service side, because they really had the right approach to their litigation.
Thank you. On that note, Janet, you spent most of your career with MEG, and as we mentioned in the bio, you recently received the Tom Marshall Award for Excellence in Public Sector Lawyers. Now, in your address to the audience, of which I was a member, you described the public lawyer's function as telling truth to power. I wonder if you could expand on what you meant by this, or what you mean by this, and how you envision public lawyers' relationship to the government that they work for.
I guess I would start with, I don't want to hold that because I'm going to be moving it all around. I would start with the role of the Attorney General. And the role of the Attorney General is a very special one in government because it is not just a political role. The Attorney General is the chief law officer of the Crown. And he is charged, or she is charged, with ensuring that the government acts within the rule of law and constitutionally. So having said that, as a lawyer working for government, I think we see ourselves as agents of the Attorney General. We don't see the Attorney General as our client. We are, in fact, the agents of the Attorney General, and we have to fulfill that responsibility. So having said that, there's a very high expectation and high responsibility, I would say, in providing advice that's independent, that is independent of partisan politics, independent of one's own personal preferences on policy bases, and independent of what may be perceived as the wishes of a particular government to be told certain things. Some governments would love to be told that it's not constitutional, for instance, for them to do something, and therefore they can't do it, and they can just say to everybody else, oh, we can't do that. But that may be the case. It may be perfectly within their authority to do it, and if they don't want to do it, well, that's a matter of political choice, and that's their choice, but it's not that they're not legally, it's not legally permissible. And so part of that is how I see telling truth to power. It has to be unvarnished advice, it has to be accessible advice, and it has to be honest and independent advice, whether or not that's what the government wants to hear or not. Now, I don't mean that you have to be rude, and I don't mean that one is abrupt. I mean, there may be, if there's issues about how one can do things in the most sort of legally permissible way, there may be options, and I think one is under an obligation to put that forward. But it's not always easy to be confronted with a very powerful person or persons who really want to hear a result. And I think our responsibility is not to give result-oriented advice and to, as I say, tell truth to power. That's how I see it.
Hmm. Carla, the ORO where you work, the Ontario Regional Office, is largely a litigation office, and it often handles very large, high-profile cases involving issues of public interest. How would you describe the interaction between litigation and policymaking?
Okay, well, the Department of Justice's role involves both making policy and enforcing law. Okay, and that flows from the dual role of the Minister of Justice. As the minister, he or she is responsible for policymaking and legislating. While as the Attorney General, as Janet was saying, is responsible for defending the government in litigation and upholding the existing laws. Now, in the Department of Justice, we have, they call it public architecture, but we've got a policy branch and then the litigation legal services branch. And the two work very closely together. Policy can inform litigation. Litigation can inform policy. On our big, high-profile cases, we always, as litigators, seek the advice of the people on the policy side, whether it's the human rights side or the international law or criminal law policy, whatever it happens to be. By the same token, the litigation side can be a driver of policy. If we lose a large case, we may have to change the law. So the two really work together. Occasionally there's a conflict, and Julie reminded me of this, where a former Minister of Justice, whom I won't name, indicated that he would decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. But that didn't quite get into law. So our prosecutors were still having to prosecute those cases, despite the fact that the minister had said that. But that's really an exception. Usually our litigation is representing what the minister has said on the policy front. So, we have great cases. Again, I just wanted to say that the Department of Justice is a great place to work. You only have to think of the marriage case or... should I mention it, the prostitution case, which we had a disappointing result on last week from our perspective. But, I mean, these are the big, important cases where the policy issues are front and center. So it's an exciting place to work, and litigation and policy have to go hand in hand.
Yes, of course. Please.
I'm sorry. I wanted to add one thing. I do apologize. Thank you.
No, of course.
I didn't want to leave any impression that it's for government lawyers to tell government what to do. Telling truth to power means telling them what to do. It's giving them advice. And with respect to advice from the Attorney General, if a government was in fact going to act clearly unconstitutionally, he or she would be under an obligation to resign. That has never happened. I can say in my experience, one became aware of some circumstances that they hadn't worked out. One might have been in that position. But governments respond to that. I mean, it's not evil if they're sort of venturing a field sometimes. It may be enthusiasm, but they can be pulled back. But part of telling truth to power is also that you have to be in a position to then execute whatever advice, whatever direction the government decides to go in after receiving your advice. And it's not for, you know, it's not that we tell government what to do in most areas. Sorry, Frank.
No, can I just
yeah,
add,
of course.
Because I think that's an incredibly important, and I sometimes have to say that I worry a bit about in the modern world whether that truth to power is being observed. It's extremely important. It's so fundamental that we are asked to tell ministers what the law is and what it's likely to be. And it's not what they want to hear, it's what we think, giving it our best shot, the law is or what it's likely to be in terms of an interpretation. And if that isn't done, then there's a real breakdown. Because, you know, one of the things that you all will probably have found out already, the thing that's fascinating about the law, particularly in the public service, is that the entry person, he or she can have an incredibly important role to play, because you're the person that takes the first look at this problem. You'll do the write-up of the memorandum or the investigation of law on it. You can't have 50 people doing it, and you can have a tremendous impact, even though, you know, it goes up a chain of people. But that beginning role that you have is immensely important. And if truth isn't part of your memorandum, I don't mean it in, you know, that kind of, but that's what I think Janet is saying, then I think the whole system is worse off.
I can say, as a very recent call to the bar, there's nothing you fear more than bringing a memo that didn't have the answer that you were hoping to get to the requesting lawyer, but you know you have to do it. So, Freya, in your career, you've worked on some significant public inquiries, such as the Walkerton inquiry, the Arar inquiry, as we heard in your introduction. These public inquiries have dealt with public policy and law. What have you, as a private sector lawyer, learned from working so closely with public sector lawyers? What are some of the advantages that you would say to both sides of that kind of partnering?
I think I have learned how very difficult it can be to be inside government at times of crisis. When we talk about truth to power, it can be a very difficult strain. It's a great advantage to go in as someone dealing with a public inquiry, delving into the dirty laundry of government decisions that were made and why, with what is essentially an unlimited budget. Honestly, it's unfair to a certain extent. So it's kind of an unusual insight into government. At the same time, what you learn through that kind of process is the tremendous number of public servants who work so very hard under great cost pressure and in areas where they don't have full information, where there are different silos of expertise, and often what we find at the end of the day is better communication would have helped change that situation. And just to broaden it a little bit more, I think it is important for all of you, as you enter the public sector, to keep in contact with your private sector counterparts, friends, law school classmates, etc. Because I think it behooves us all to understand the way in which public and private sector lawyers, and indeed our culture as a whole, relate. Because I think as we drift apart to a certain extent, we don't help our society at all. I think it's very important to keep those up. And as I look at all of you starting out on your careers in the public sector, what you may not realize is you may not stay where you are now for the next 35 years, that those types of careers are unusual. You may drift back into private sector for a little while. You may go off to Europe and do something fun at one of those international tribunals, etc. So I think Justice Iacobucci referred to relationships, relationship building. It's something that begins here and it begins now. You have to keep up your entire life, and you have to keep up that dedication to public service no matter where you find yourself. And we'll give a plug for the OBA, because I started out, I was chair of the constitutional law section for a while. It's a great place. OBA, Advocate Society, all of these boards, which engage both public and private lawyers, are very important. And they're particularly important at the beginning of your career, because that's how you actually meet people and begin to understand the pressures of their job, the kind of law they practice, and so on. So all of these are very important at giving you insight and actually helping you make choices for the future, too.
Now, I had prepared a second individual question for each of you, but given the time, I thought that I might just go ahead and address the more general question. So for all of the panelists, the last question is, considering your own career in the public sector and drawing from your own experiences and memories, what's the one thing that you know now that you wish you had known when you were first starting out in your early years of practice? We would love to know. Sure.
Well, have you got about 3 hours or this one? I wish. Oh gosh, I don't know where to start. I grew up in Vancouver, and I went to UBC. And at the time, in my high school, because of my Italian background, I got really keen in Latin. I took 7 years of Latin. But I remember going, my homeroom teacher in high school was the French teacher of the high school. It was a small high school. And I went to her and I said, you know, Miss Language, I wonder whether I should take French. And she says, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, I don't know. I seem to be thinking about law. I always had being a doctor in mind, but the fact is, I couldn't stand the sight of blood, and I wasn't very. And so I kept thinking about law. She said, "Oh well, no. You must take." This is my French teacher, and she was really a wonderful teacher. She said, "No, you just continue with your Latin. You don't worry about French." Well, I really missed. I think I missed out. I should have taken both. And so when I went to the Justice Department as deputy, I don't know whether, Carla, you heard my French, but if you did, you ears were ringing. It was brutal. I mean, it was brutal. So now I say, quand je parle la langue de Molière, c'est toujours avec un accent de la langue de Dante que du Mine. And I, you know, and then when I speak Italian, it's the language of Shakespeare. And so I'm schizophrenic about languages. And I just wish I had taken French. And the other thing I did that I, knowing is that, you know, law is such a derivative discipline. It depends so much on other disciplines. It's not a, you know, it doesn't have a freestanding kind of a disciplinary kind of dimension like mathematics, which has fundamental theorems and sort of building on all this, and it's demonstrably provable. Law is, as I said, to the most challenging audience I have ever addressed in my life was 13-year-olds in British Columbia who were genii. They were on the campus of UBC because they were just off the charts, and they were to go into first-year university at age 14. And I was asked by their teacher to come and talk to them. He heard that I was going to be in Vancouver. Why? He wanted to get them thinking about other things other than science, and their model, their exemplar, was Gates, Bill Gates. They were all computer geeks par excellence. I gave this pitch on the charter as best I could, and this kid is doodling in the front row when I'm giving it, and he puts up his hand after the talk and says, well, sir, after all, this, isn't it just your opinion?
And it's, it's, there's precedent and there's argument and there's policy aspects to this and there's principle. Yeah, but it's still your opinion. So the point I'm getting at is that I wish I'd had a better, I think I would have been better off a wider undergraduate education. This is my point here. I took commerce in a time when it was very narrow. It's much better now. But it was dismal in the time I took it. And I think I lost an opportunity to get exposed to areas of life and scholarship that really do have an influence in the law and the administration of justice. So those are my regrets. But I'm a half-baked humanist. I'm a half-baked philosopher. I'm a half-baked historian. And I'm probably a three-quarters baked lawyer.
Well, there was so much I didn't know. It's hard to know where to start. So I'm changing it around a little bit. I was very fortunate, especially when I started in government, to have a really wonderful mentor. And so what I'm really going to do is pass on three points that he made very clear to me and which I think was excellent advice. Two of them are, I think, could be subtitled, "You Are Not Alone." And the third one is, "You're a little bit alone there." The first one was, "You are not alone, ask for help." When you start out, whether you're articling, whether you're a beginning lawyer, frankly, whether you're a lawyer at any time, there are bound to be issues that really would be easier to deal with if you were discussing them with somebody else, preferably somebody with more experience or more knowledge. But even if not, just arguing with a colleague or a peer can really help you appreciate more aspects of the problem or the dimensions of the problem. You've all heard about mentoring. It's a big buzzword now. It's extremely important. I don't think we called them mentors back in my day, but that role was very important, and I think that it can help immeasurably. You should have more than one, probably. Some people are good mentors in one area and some in another, and they don't have to have an official title. But seek advice. Don't be worried if you think you've made a mistake. Most mistakes are quite repairable, and the sooner you get to that, the better, so don't hide it. And just, as I say, rely on your colleagues, both your peers and your people who are more experienced. The second one is to participate in the profession, and this, I think, is picking up on some of what Frey has already said. And that is, I was very encouraged when I arrived at government. Don't just concentrate your efforts here. Join the OBA. Join the Advocate Society if you're a litigator. Get involved in other organizations. For one thing, it's just collegial. It's a bit of a release to talk to people and find out they've got the same problems you do, and you can laugh about them a bit more instead of stewing. Secondly, you can learn a great deal from people. You can learn a great deal from going to programs. It can broaden your appreciation of legal problems. It's a way of also, I think, contributing to the profession and your colleagues the same way by that kind of interchange. So I think it's both making a contribution and also self-fulfillment to join with the profession and try and stay out of silos. So that's the "you are not alone." Now, this is the one where there's a little more responsibility here, and that is ultimately, I think, We are responsible for our own development as lawyers. We've got to look at what our experience is. If we're aiming in a particular direction, are we getting it? If you're working in government, for instance, you're working in an office where these files are going to be assigned by a director, you may be in somebody's working group. I mean, different offices are organized different ways. It's very hard for a senior lawyer always to remember exactly what a junior lawyer is doing, has done, has made great progress here, but not so much there. You're the one that needs to monitor that and bring it to the attention, in a polite way. Gee, I haven't done too many cross-examinations, Don't assume that somebody is thinking, oh, three cross-examinations, that person knows everything, don't need any more. Or alternatively, who cares if they, that's it. People don't micromanage that way usually, and you really need to develop, I think, a bit of a kind of self-assessment list in areas that you want to work in, and to try and ensure that you're getting that experience. And then, secondly, in that line, you're going to plateau at a particular point. It always happens, but the point is to move on from the plateau. You need a little bit of rest sometime after you've been through something. But, one needs to keep moving, and I think one of the great things about our profession is that you can keep moving. You always keep developing intellectually and skill-wise. It's unending, so from that perspective, very stimulating. But you're the one who's responsible for your reputation. You'll hear, it's trite to say, you lose your reputation in law, you don't have anything, but I think that's very close. And you're the one that can ruin that, not your director. Your colleagues can make a difference, but you're the one, and you need to develop that, not just from acting through integrity. I don't think anybody here would wish to act in a way that would further integrity, but also just in terms of your skill and your excellence. You're the one that people talk about afterwards. You think judges don't talk behind your back, and I hate to say this, but I know it's true. Judges will say to me, oh, your colleague so-and-so was just in front of me the other day, did a great job, or your colleague was a before me little junior for that case, don't you think? I mean, they're not being negative. They're just trying to be helpful. But people talk amongst the profession, amongst the judiciary, amongst academia, I think. And I think it's important to always know that, and it's for you to establish your reputation and to maintain it. So, if you want to advance yourself, you do need to be a bit visible, and I don't mean to go off in some horrible self-promotion project, but, other people are probably not going to do that for you. And so, I just really urge you to maintain professional relationships across the board as much as you can, and contribution to the profession is a very fulfilling part of it.
Thank you.
Well, I guess what I tried to do was think of the first 5 years of practice, and I think what I didn't realize was just how valuable experience can be. If I were giving myself advice at this point, I would have said, well, during those first 5 years, explore all the options that are available to you in the Department of Justice. What I did was I found a niche, and I got really comfortable there. And I suppose I could have stayed there for my entire career. That wouldn't have been good for me, and it wouldn't have been good for the department. I didn't appreciate until about that five-year mark just how many opportunities there were and how incredibly important the work was and how many wonderful people we have in the department. I guess what I would say to myself now, looking back, is look for smart people and for hard problems, because that's how you're going to grow. And that finally dawned on me at about year five, and that's when I got involved, again by accident and with a great deal of luck, in some very big important commercial transactions. I sold airports. That's what I needed to do. So that's sort of what I would take away from it. Look for smart people and hard problems, and you'll never regret it.
Thank you. Freya?
I think now that I've been practicing 21 years, I can easily say the first 6 years I made every mistake in the book. I honestly felt everything I was doing, it felt like I was doing everything for the first time. This is going to be my first this, and I might miss a filing deadline, or I felt bad because on cross I didn't do a perfect job. And I think I beat myself up an awful lot the first 6 years. I can say in retrospect, don't do that, but maybe it's something that you have to go through. Maybe it's evolutionary. Because I think as you get more experience under your belt, you feel competent. And I think by this stage, you just feel like, honestly, it gets better every year for me. And I think it's the accumulation of the experience. But I know that young lawyers can be very hard on themselves. But learn from that. Learn from how hard you are on yourself. If you make a mistake, think about why you made the mistake, what work habits you have adopted that are perhaps standing in your way. And something I did do very consciously was, as Janet advised, invest in yourself. For me, it was in advocacy, because advocacy doesn't necessarily get better the more you appear in court. Because I've seen lots of lawyers who go before tribunals all the time who are not very good. They're not well organized. They're not persuasive. They don't examine well, and so on. So I think I read all this, you know, advocacy literature. I pursued through the Advocate Society a great deal of training. I, you know, practiced the night before my argument, so I might practice in a dictaphone or before the mirror. I might try to tell my husband, you know, if you can explain to your husband or your mother why this case that you're going to the Supreme Court of Canada with on pensions is important and interesting in an accessible way, it's a great practice, and it will sure help you be a lot better in your presentation at court. So I think for me, I sort of look back now, and it might be because I'm a woman. I think things are changing. Certainly when I started out, and even if I look around, there's not that many, you know, senior women litigators around, are there? So there weren't a lot of role models. And I think sometimes I did find it. And I worked for Dennis O'Connor, who's an amazing person. But I was never going to be Dennis. Like, he's a guy, and he's a good, you know, 20-odd years older. I had to find my own way. And I think much of the practice of law is about finding your own way and learning from your mistakes, with the idea that at the end of it, as long as you're pursuing your passion, that you will have a wonderful and exciting career.
Well, thank you. I'm going to turn the floor over to Val thank you. I'd also like to say thank you. And as someone who's been a member of the bar for 4 months now, I was taking notes. So I hope you've all learned as much as I did. So, Val, there you go.
So first, I want to say thanks to Monica for doing such a great job with moderating the panel. So I'm up here just to thank you so very much for coming out tonight and for sharing your candid thoughts and your honest advice. I've been out for almost 10 years, and this to me is extremely valuable, and I hope it was as valuable to all of you as it was to me. We're very grateful and lucky that we have people like you in our community who come out and talk to us. So thank you very much. We have a very, where possible, a small token of our appreciation. and thanks again.
Thank you.
I don't know if Julia is still here. Julia and, I don't know if Guillermo is here. There we go. So we have two representatives of the Young Lawyers Division and the Articling Students Division. Just have a real quick, another final plug for for getting involved. And I'll just turn it over to Julia and Guillermo.
Thanks. First of all, I'd just like to say, as an articling student who's working in a private firm who does quite a bit of public law work, it's been very inspiring, and I'd like to thank our panelists for the great words. I'll be very brief. I have a few notes written on receipt here, so I have to be very brief. Articling students, most of you I look at in the crowd look like articling students, but today articling students are from, you know, very different backgrounds. It's not just people in their first careers. Law could be your second or third career. So I'd like to make the plug for the student division of the Ontario Bar Association. We're here to represent your interests. So please, if you have any questions or concerns, we're here to bring your interests to the OBA. So we have both the Toronto Articling Student Representatives, Omar and Jennifer, here tonight as well for that. And as an Articling Student member, you also get access to two free sections, like the Public Sector Lawyers section. So please feel free to join if you haven't joined already, and join those two sections. And I'll turn it over to Guillermo Chible, who's the chair of the Young Lawyers Division, to say a few words.
Thank you. I'm the chair of Young Lawyers Central, actually. Young Lawyers has three different divisions. The other is East, and the other is Southwest Ontario. I joined the executive of the Young Lawyers Central just over 4 years ago. And during the time that I've been involved with the OBA, I have learned that all of the people invariably who are running the show, so to speak, along with the assistance of staff, are willing to help young lawyers get involved with the number of activities that the OBA does. so that if an initiative is being undertaken, the Young Lawyers Division Central, as well as the others, I can only imagine, get asked whether the YLD wants to send somebody from the executive or the section otherwise for some input on legislation that's being considered or a networking event. And this is a perfect example. This opportunity to address you is completely underserved. I had nothing to do with this program, but yet here I am getting to speak to you and enjoying an evening with members of the profession, a justice of the Supreme Court of Canada. And if that doesn't convince you to join for free, I don't know what will. So I encourage you to consider the OBA and to make the most of those 4 free months that you're going to have upon your call to the bar. Test what we can do for you, and I'm sure you will be a lifelong member. Thank you.
Okay, so on that note, I'd like to thank you all once again for coming out. We really appreciate it. I think there's a bit of time for just some informal mingling at the end. I don't know if there's any super minglers left in the crowd, but if there are, mingle away. So thanks again.